Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you, Vince and the boys. That was Vince Guaraldi. Yeah, that was my cat. That was Vince Guaraldi and his trio with the soundtrack from what all of us kids from the 50s remember is a Charlie Brown Christmas. And that was a superb choice for this evening, Dan. I love that.
Yeah, no, I was I've been a big Vince Guaraldi fan for a while. Just he, like you said, from you know, from when we're kids, right? You just it's
yeah.
part of kind of growing up watching Charlie Brown Christmas and all that
DNA.
And that song. It, to-
yeah,
it totally is. It really is.
Yeah,
but I love
you,
that
you
song.
Can't, you can't hear that without thinking of the Charlie Brown Christmas.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was just dancing just like they did when they're standing there and the scene when they're all dancing to it. I was literally just doing that.
I'd buy tickets to that.
Yeah, yeah. No. You'd want your money back. But that that was actually the first song I ever learned on keyboards on piano when I was in college. I used to go down to the practice rooms and kind of bang around, and I just remember sitting there and I was playing it, and I had music on it in the key of C, so I was learning. I was literally learning how to play piano, playing that song. And I just remember this piano teacher walking in and go, "All right, no, I can't take this anymore." And he walked up to me and said, "Here's how you play it. It's in A minor or whatever it was." It was in. So he was like getting annoyed and hearing me trying to play it in C.
Yeah.
It's the first song I ever learned. I never learned the solo parts, but I could play the whole thing all the way through without the solos.
I know how your music teacher feels. That's exactly how I feel when I listen to native Virginians trying to speak Italian. I want to put knitting in my ear. Yeah, it's terrible. It's
Exactly.
Vedas Fiatri. No, okay. Hurricane Ozono de Qui. Oh, please stop.
But no, Viscarelli's great, underrated, yeah. And he does a lot of stuff. You know, he's got a lot of music out there besides, the Charlie Brown, the Peanuts stuff. So definitely check that out. But he pretty much did the soundtracks to all of the earlier ones. And for those of you who are George Winston fans, if you know who he is, he was very influenced by Vince Guaraldi, and actually did a Vince Guaraldi. On albums, so one of his albums is actually a tribute to the Vince Guaraldi stuff. So he does a bunch of cover songs on an album of all those songs, which I highly recommend. I love George Winston, one of my favorites as well too.
Well, put the link out there. Put the link out there.
Yeah. Let me see if I can find it. Absolutely.
Yeah,
I would love to talk about music for the next 2 hours, but I'd also love to talk about poetry, and I think we should probably do that. So we have a bunch of stuff. We do have some carryovers from last week, and we should probably, knowing how much you and I talk, we should probably get into it before we end up, you know, with
friend used to say, go on with your note.
Yeah, exactly. If we don't get started, we might end up with all carryovers next week. So we should probably.
Now there's a goal. We set a record. Okay. Well,
exactly.
Because you ported them over to me a little bit after I had already done the board. You'll find the carryovers at the bottom.
Yeah, I do have them here. We are.
Yeah, and there they are.
Ready to rock.
Yeah.
So we have a couple. Yeah. So we're gonna start.
My cat and I are ready.
Oh, good. Excellent. Excellent. Yep. So we are ready to go. And ladies can go first if you want. So the first one we have is by Scott Sharp called What is a Dream? And I posted that. So let's get right into it.
So let's pull that up. Oh, that's a brevity. Okay. And this is just to remind folks that this is from the Bill. I think this. No, this is not from the Bill Meyer. This is from the. Hit me in the forehead with a shoe. I've gone blank. It's not Bill Meyer. Who was our previous contest?
It is Thomas Hart Benton.
Thank you. Yes. Bailed me out. Oh boy,
no
I tell
problem.
You, I should know. I.
Yeah,
I
you do the contest. You should know.
I should. But you know, seriously, I sit here and I pour over I pour over artists in volume, and sometimes I forget. So anyway, here we go with What is the Dream? And it is from the Thomas Hart Benton contest. The American dream, torn apart as if by a Midwestern tornado. A house, the wife and kids, thrown about on the winds of change. What now do we seek? On what foundation do we stand? The church turned on its side, praying to accumulated things. We clean up after the storm. But can we rebuild what we had? End poem. And that was inspired by Prompt 7.
Yeah, that was a great read. And as always with Scott, he's I've been seeing kind of more and more brevities with him, and I think this is really neat. I like this one a lot. It's to me basically kind of like the double meaning. And this did win an honorable mention on the contest. And it's the double meaning of the American dream of people literally going out to the Midwest and their houses being destroyed by storms, right? So they go out there as the American dream to sit there and getting by storms. But also, I think he's talking about the kind of Americana being turned around and being broken up, which I think is really interesting. And I like how he kind of brought religion there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. Maybe it's just me, but I think a lot of people don't necessarily think of the United States as a hugely religious country, right? You think of Islam, right? Egypt, Iraq, right? India. You think of all these places as hugely religious, but we are very very religious in this country. Absolutely. But there's a huge amount of Christianity here as well, too. I mean, there really is big, big religions of people who are very, very serious about it. I've had a lot of conversations with people on religion and that. It's fascinating to me. I can't say that I'm devoted to any religion, but I am a student of all, I think. I've read so many different religious texts, and I enjoy talking about the philosophy of it and the history of it. You know, it's interesting. So I think the way he kind of talked about that, the church turns on its side, praying to accumulate things. We clean up after the storm. How much craziness and just in the world, but let alone in the United States too, has there been because of religions? How many, you know, different sects? I always.
How many centuries would you like back?
Exactly. And, you know, and it's always too bad, right? You know, religion gets a bad rap a lot of times from a certain amount of people, you know, just like, you know, I say you can't judge, you know, Islam by Osama bin Laden. You can't judge Catholics by Timothy McVeigh, you know. You know, my son, we don't, I'm not overly practicing it Catholic now, but we raised my son Catholic and we've gone to, church. My son actually wanted to kind of explore it when he was younger. He said, we weren't going to church. And my son, literally, I remember what he said it. He goes, Dad, we should really go to church. It's the least we can do. And I said, all right, Danny. And so we started going and just talking to the priest. He was like the nicest guy. You know, and everybody there was so friendly, and that's, I think, most religious people do embrace the love and fellowship of it, as opposed to this.
Yeah.
Anyway, I could go on and on, but this is what Scott made me think of, so I'm overtired, so I'm going to talk too much. I have to control myself here tonight. So, Pat, so on to you, Bobby. What are your thoughts?
Exactly. Do what I do, drugs and therapy. It always works.
That's right.
I was just going to observe, though, that truthfully, I think in any discipline or following, regardless, be it religion or science or politics or philosophy or physical fitness or what have you, anything where people tend to become zealots and tend to discount anything other than what's in their own mainstream, their own discipline or philosophical pursuit, they tend to get, I think, myopic about everything else and become very focused on just the one thing. And I think that it shows more with dogma. I think it shows more with politics, too, with dogma and politics.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's true of anything. I know people who are hardcore card carrying militant vegetarians. You know, you want to terrorize them, threaten them with butter. You know, it's anything that is followed so strictly that people become oblivious to any kind of competing. And I think that's what the virtue of America is. That people don't realize that. Simply because you disagree with someone does not necessarily make them wrong or the enemy.
Right.
And people lost sight of that. It's just horrible to me that just, you know, you can disagree with someone, you know, and still care about them or just, you know, still respect them as a person. But anyway, so I'm looking at the prompt, and it's the house partly torn apart and then another house on its side sitting on top of a car and God knows what stuck up in a tree. But it definitely portrayed the aftermath of a tornado with verbally a great deal of accuracy. And I've seen the aftermath of tornadoes and they're just, it's horrific. But I do like the way, like you said, he integrates the philosophy of the aftermath. Do we rebuild what we had? Can we rebuild what we had as a civilization, as a culture? And I think that's a very astute observation, and I'm glad he threaded that in there.
Yeah, and Pee-wee said the old Bible Belt got its name for a reason. That's right, because they study the old Bible, and if their kids don't agree with them, they get hit with the old belt. That's where they get.
I like that.
That's where they came from. All right, cool. Let's move on.
Yeah, because we're 14.
Guess.
And we only one bone down.
That's right. We'll go. I'll try not to get distracted. I think that was my fault. All right, since there's only two of us, this will be easy. It's my turn to read. I just got to go back and forth here.
Yep.
And this one that I just posted is by Greg Gall. It's called Parks, Places, People. Olmsted Law of Verdad Pass of our core, urban sprawl separated at a cost that let us know nature and adore. Those who wander find awe is not lost. Wilderness lands surely shape our view. Songs of soil, stone, and star, none too far. See what we as humankind dare do, conquer the inner self where we are. Landscape concerts to which all can go. Futures for youth lie beyond the grids, where one can become their own maestro. Raise up nature's promise for the kids. Parks and places for all our people. Space for worship without a steeple. End poem. And I thought this was really great. you know, this really brings back, you know, I've always been fascinated with that whole time with Muir when he was around, and when Teddy Roosevelt, and they were all kind of discovering and kind of creating, you know, or creating but declaring the national parks. You know, that must have been kind of a fascinating time to really get there. Nowadays, we can all sit there and look on Google Maps and see everything, but to be able to really find those areas and the majesty that, you know, there's so much amazing nature in the United States. And I really love that. Parks and places for people, spaces to worship without a steeple. You know, and that's what those, the national parks can be now. So I really thought this was a great tribute to that part of Americana, the discovery and the focus on nature, which I think we all have to get back to. So yeah, well, what do you think about all that, Bobby? Uh-oh, Bobby got the mutating monster, I think.
I was talking to the, yeah, I was being brilliant to the mute. Trivia, if you, next time you take a trivia test, and interestingly enough, President Woodrow Wilson was the one that in 1916 signed the act creating the National Park Service.
Yep.
Roosevelt made it popular because he started going out there and exploring it. And he was a rugged naturalist. Matter of fact, in the White House, I believe he had a grizzly bear that he had shot, stuffed and mounted, displayed in the White House. So.
Yeah, I've read his memoirs of when he was down. He's got a book out with memoirs of when he explored the Amazon, which is really fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's where he bought it, isn't it?
In the Amazon?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I might be wrong. You might be right. I don't know.
I think so. He succumbed to some malaria or something. I don't know.
It's a good question.
Yeah, I don't think he finished the sojourn. But the National Park Service, seriously, we just this year christened a new one. I think it's called Great Gorge, and I think it's West Virginia. So it's nearby.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I didn't know there was a park. I didn't know that.
Brand new, and beautiful. And if you look at some of these national parks, it's just you've got to be impressed with the foresight and the forward thinking of our progenitors in setting aside all of this land. So we can enjoy it. Now, I think places like Yosemite and the Grand Canyon, they've actually had to limit the number of people that go in there because they're just carbon monoxide, internal combustion engine fumes. I know when we were skiing, out there in that area. One year, we took a snowmobile tour of Yosemite, of Yellowstone, and they only allow certain number of vehicles in there a day because of the emissions.
Huh.
And
interesting.
It was, if you've never explored the parks in snow, it is just an amazing thing. it was mind blowing, just to see it, and because it was limited access, and you were the only people out there. And it was just that little troop of us out there just exploring. So it was great.
Pam actually said he died in New York. Yeah, I looked that up. He actually died. He was 60. He had a blood clot in his lungs. So it was kind of just natural causes.
Okay.
But he did say, she said he did get extremely sick and almost died in the Amazon.
Yeah.
I know he made it back. Yeah. I read his memoir. So I know
they had him stuffed and mounted next to the grizzly bear.
No. And yeah, the Rough Riders, man. Teddy, I picked. Toughest president ever, I picked Teddy Roosevelt, let me tell you.
He was definitely a rugged individualist. At one point during a boxing sparring match, he actually got blinded in one eye and was able to conceal that from his family and his staff.
Well, was he the one that got shot when he was giving his inaugural speech? Is this a urban legend? And he actually got shot in a Bible that was in his thing, and he bled a little bit. He sat there and just finished his speech and then said, okay, take me to the hospital.
I don't know, but that sounds like a good homework assignment for you.
Yeah, is that an urban myth? I don't know. I'll have to figure that one out. I swear that there was a president
that
actually got shot and finished his speech. But anyway, we are getting
okay. –
oh, true. Pee-wee says true. So, yeah, interesting. Anyway, we are getting – over.
Thank you, Pee-wee.
I keep complaining
you?
Not to get distracted, and I keep distracting us. So we should
probably – Well, back from tangent land.
Going.
Who's next? We have
exactly.
We have how John got to know Catherine.
We do. I'm going to post that right now. Give me a second here.
Okay.
And that's definitely not a brevity, but that is your turn up there. So –
That's okay.
I will let you. Let's all sit back and
deeply.
Get
I will
a drink
inhale
and
deeply.
Relax. And
Holy
cat!
Yeah, do your taxes while I'm reading this. okay, this is by St. John, Niner. How John got to know Catherine, a common jelly for storyline. Part 16, BOMB, is now ha-ha. I have a funny feeling that some of this is inside joke. But I'm going to read this anyway. So especially thank you. And it says to be continued on the bottom with no prompt. So this is one of those stray ones we got. Okay, John was well built and strong, yet he could feel the iron grips that held him at a gunpoint over his muscular arms. John knew this was not fiction, but a real situation he was in. He was wise to stay put his gunpoint as dug in ready, and he could feel the cold steel. One of his assailants let go of his arm, held the escalator, and stepped out in the lobby and carefully watched both sides and whistled low. This was an indication for the other two to push John out as the escalator made its way back. The corridor was a corporate work area and thickly carpeted and ran about 650 meters, and John looked askance and could notice it was deserted. Suddenly, an open window in front attracted John's attention, and his mind began to work. He made a quick guess that he was about four floors below the roof where he had intended to reach. For now, John was pushed ahead and walked 100 meters before he was pushed inside a door. Inside was a penthouse kind of apartment with a clear balcony of 10 by 15. The party pulled the curtain over window and locked the door from inside. John was pushed into a chair and tied with a climber's tough rope tight, and his mouth was taped rather badly. Then his three assailants sat down on two couches and began their deliberations. Two began to talk in hushed tones. Gun-toter was taking out another gun with silencer and loading it. Suddenly, handset of one assailant rang, and he busily talked for about 15 seconds and then barked, "Schmucks, these people would send you loans when you're about to assassinate a guy. In 3 minutes of the call, the intercom, the room rang loud. Same assailant picked up the intercom and announced to the two others, "Bartender is on his way. Time to celebrate a bit with wines and a little party. You have a precious catch in control." The other two nodded. This party was waiting for some person or instructions, perhaps. After about 10 minutes, the doorbell rang, and one assailant barked, "Come in," and yanked the door lock. A bartender party of two smiled and stepped in with a table. did the curtsy and began to move back, go out of the door. Two assailants grabbed table, ripped cover, napkin, and corked open two wine bottles. With other hand, they grabbed eatables and began swigs and munches. Suddenly, the two bartenders stopped short of stepping out of the door, and with tiger agility, turned back to face John's assailants, and two revolvers were whipped out of their hands, with one bartender holding two, each one hand. Before anybody could realize anything, three thud sounds were heard, and assailants with their mouths full of wine and eatables fell with muffled screams of pain, each with a gaping red bleeding hole in their forehead. One bartender moved quickly to untie John and whispered, "Sir Boris in lead, and we need to hurry. Enemies are on the trail. To be continued."
All right. Excellent read. Go get a glass of water and a snack and take a break there. So I just wanted to just continue real quick. Wikipedia, take that, you know, with a grain of salt. During a campaign speech in Milwaukee, he did get assassinated, and it was actually, it says here, his 50-page text of his speech saved, and the metal glasses in his pocket that saved his life. Shot. He finished his speech. So that was Teddy.
That is interesting.
Yep. So I'm assuming, I don't know which prompt this was either, but I'm assuming it was one of the prompts, and he basically, yeah, he got a story out of this, which I think was a big theme last time that we had, and I thought this was really interesting. You know, and I said this in my comment, I'm becoming more a fan of the poetry type stories. Also, the way he writes the stories, I do like the To Be Continued, and I do like the, you know, George Lucas, I've mentioned this before, I think, in a show, that he always said there's no such thing as a beginning and an end to a story. Everybody comes in, right. There's always something that happened before and always something that happened after. So I do like it when it's like the, you know, the little piece of what's going inside. And you know, this is a part of Americana, as the last show was about, that, you know, was there. We have to remember, I mean, there was a time when there was gunfights and there was the old Wild West. You know, some people are trying to bring that back for, you know, for whatever, but
Wild West now. I live in Chicago.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know what I mean? There are places where it's still like that. Right. Exactly. Unfortunately, but you know, it is part of Americana, of just having that kind of Wild West where everybody kind of fights each other. And so I thought this is interesting and well told. What'd you think when you were reading it?
It's very imaginative. Very imaginative. He's clearly, you can see he's visualizing the story as he's writing it. It's a little disjointed, but I think all in all, not bad. It's I do wish he would have attached it to something, some prompt, because it just doesn't. It just kind of dangles out there in midair with no relevance to the contest. So and that's why we put all the prompts out there, is for people to, if they draw some inspiration from the contest, the prompts to let us know which ones they are. I was thinking St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which actually was on Chicago's north side on St. Valentine's Day in 1929. And I actually, when I was growing up, my uncle and my grandmother made a point of taking me by the building and showing me where it was. Quick story. My uncle, who grew up in Chicago. My grandmother was Polish, but my uncle was very tall, very dark. If for all of you who know who your old actors are, he looked like a cross between Yul Brynner and Gregory Peck. Very dark eyes, dark hair, tall, very imposing figure, lanky. But anyway, he was in the army, and he was at South Camp Polk, now Fort Polk, and he said that he went into the town, Leesville, for a haircut, and he was in his fatigues. And he said that they had run out of duty belts. So he was on duty. They had issued him a shoulder holster. So he had the shoulder holster under his fatigue jacket. And he walked into the barber shop, and he sat down in the chair. And the barber says, you know, everybody's a southern Louisiana accent. He says, I'll be right with you. And my uncle says, fine. So he sits down and says, so the barber calls him over, and then my uncle removes his jacket. And he's got the shoulder holster under. He hangs up the jacket, and the barber says, where are you all from? And my uncle looks at him and says, Chicago. And my uncle said it's the best damn haircut he ever got, and he didn't pay a cent for it.
Yep.
Because he thought he was a gangster. And that was in the 50s. So it was late, early 50s, late 40s. That was a very prevalent attitude for a long time. So anyway,
yeah,
back
yep,
in
yep.
Atlanta. It was my turn.
That's okay. That's okay. Yeah, that's okay.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, we got some more here. So we got another one here. We got two more from last week. So I'm going to post this one, and I'm going to read this one. More of a brevity,
okay.
But that's okay. It's by Damn It Dave, and this is called Roundup in the Snow. Cowboys yell and herd the horses. To corrals in town they go, paid to keep them on their courses as they gallop through the snow. Mustangs race across the meadow. Freedom quickly nears its end. They don't know their precious cargo. Buyers wait around the bend. End poem. And I really loved the classic. I heard this term last night when I was listening to Part Sinner, Part Saint, and I do like that, the kind of classic rhyming where it just every other line, and it's well well put together with the phrasing. You know, I'm a fan of when you rhyme. To me, it's yeah. Exactly. And I'm a fan of rhyming. To me, always seems musical, so I always try to have it with the syllables match, which he did a great job of that. And this is, again, another part of Americana, which is the cattle rustlers and the horses and the cattle. I mean, a huge part of the United States that is still there, not as prevalent or romanticized as it was before. But it is absolutely still there, and I thought this was really, really interesting. You know, maybe not as many horse wranglers or horse farms, but because people aren't getting around, right? That was a huge way of people getting around before was by horse. But I thought this was very, very again romanticized and beautifully done. Brevity. So yeah, great job. What do you think of horses there?
I like his illustration. He did choose a prompt. I just can't remember which one it was. I think this is as you said. He's got his meter for every other line is perfectly matched. He's got the same meter for the first and third line, and for the second and fourth. And his rhyming pattern, he has got a very pleasing cadence to this piece. And for brevity, it tells a story, and it tells it very well. I mean, you can just in the eight lines that he's got there, you know what's going on. So it's very well constructed. It's a nice read, and I think it is well inspired by the Americana that we put out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. Pee Wee says he actually lives only an hour away from Chicago, so he's been there. Fellow Chicagoan, Chicagoite?
Chicagoan.
What do you call it? Chicagoan, okay. All right, so our last one from last time is actually from the lovely and talented Pam. And I thought we had done – I'm reading this one, and I'm like, did we do this one? But we didn't. We had one on the same picture, the prompt, and one that was kind of a similar theme as well, I think is what it was. That's why it looked a little familiar to me. But, this is our last one from Pam. If you want to give that a read, that would be great.
You betcha. Let me tee this up here and put the roundup away. And we have Alone – and his memories. Yeah, this was something that was I think was at it was a pre-write by Frank by Poetic Picasso. He did a beautiful job on it, this also I thought was a very very well done write. So this was by Pam, Alone in His Memories. Deep Lines of Living, Tide Curls of Salt and Pepper, Jatoba Tree Skin, Blue Jean Overalls, A Man Who Has Known Hard Work, Wool Coat with Rips and Patches. He sits in silence, a lone figure in the crowd, clutching onto his red cane. His joints creak with pain. He refuses to grumble, stoic in resolve. Lost in memories, joy and sorrow mixed together, detailed creation. He has known pure love, cruelty of mankind, his children laughing. The spark in her soul, Mary, his sweet beloved, tears from cocoa eyes. Churches burning, bodies hanging from branches, the cries for justice. His family gone, where the angels sing old hymns, aches to be with them. End poem.
Excellent.
She's got a beautiful she got a beautiful Sanrio chain here. Beautifully done.
Yeah, absolutely. And she got an honorable mention, well deserved on that. So I thought this was great. She really got into the character, and I love the description on this. As usual from Pam, she does a great job with that. Where was it here? She got into the character very well. I love the lost in memories, joy and sorrow mixed together, detailed creation. He has known pure love, the cruelty of mankind, his children laughing, and the spark of her soul. I think of that. I mean, I'm not, you know, as old as I'm assuming the gentleman in this picture is, but, you know, I still think back a lot of times on all the things that I've seen and everything that you've gone through. And it is amazing. You know, we have short lives, but a lot of us have so much that we've gone through with that. And to be able to kind of think back and reflecting, I think of that often now when I do see elder people or older people of, you know, the things that they have seen and gone through. I have a 102-year-old aunt, you know, and I think like, geez, you know, she lived through the Great Depression. She was a young child, but she was actually there. And, you know, my father did too. He's passed away, but, you know, there's, you know, she's somebody who actually can remember that and you know, to think of that, and then somebody to look back and see their family gone. You know, there are, like with her, you know, her, she's the last one my aunt Sue, she's the last one in the family. All her brothers and sisters are gone. Her parents are obviously gone. She hasn't, luckily for her, like for everybody, she hasn't lost any of her kids, but I mean, she has an 80-year-old son. You know, so there's, you know, you kind of, when you're that age, you see everybody that, mm-hmm. that goes. I think of the movie, if you've ever seen the movie or read the book, The Green Mile, at the end of the movie, he talks about his curse where he has to sit there and watch everybody he knows and loves die. And that's his curse of being, you know, living as long as he does. And all of these things that she got out of the picture, I thought was beautiful. And the title, Alone in His Memories, I think really, really captures that. So fantastic job, Pam. And you had the honor of reading it. What did you think?
I've always enjoyed Pam's work. She has, she's a very gifted writer, and to tell a story within the structures, the confines of a Sanrio chain is quite a nimble feat. I've attempted it several times. I think I've succeeded once or twice. But this is it tends to compress everything that's being expressed, but I think it does it in such a way that you get the essence of what you're looking at. There's no fripperies. There's no frills in here. But I just She's expressed very eloquently just the emotions in this picture. It says, lost in memories, joy and sorrow mixed together, detailed creation. He has known pure joy, the cruelty of mankind, his children's laughing. And you can see, and he looks like he's caught in a reverie. And I think she captured that beautifully in what she wrote. So well done, Pam. Nicely done.
Absolutely. And Pam actually said, great read, Bobby. Thanks for your wonderful comments. You're welcome, Pam. Thanks for the wonderful poem. And with that said, guess what? We are up to our new contest. Very exciting. So what do we have tonight there?
We're only 40 minutes into the show.
Exactly. Well, we got time. We got some time. We can get a few of them done.
No, but, you know, we have a unique relationship with linear time.
Exactly, yeah. We'll see what we can do here.
Well, this contest, I'm trying to keep things for around the holidays a little bit light and breezy. And for this particular contest, I picked the artwork. I'm looking for the – there we go. Oh, that's the wrong one. Too many. I'm the victim of too many tabs open at the top of the. Okay, there we go. Here it is. I would have had to close the contest, by the way. Okay, 16 is enough. We have the whimsical gouache of Bill Mayer. Now, gouache is a. It's actually a type of material. It's a. It's an opaque watercolor of the type used in gouache painting or a method. But his and he's done quite a bit of illustrating for different companies, done advertising for them. But his artwork is, it takes animals and anthropomorphizes them, puts them in clothing. But he's also got some very they got some very imaginative creatures in here that I thought would be inspirational for our writers. Although I'm surprised that no one wrote the sugar and spice. I'm a little disappointed in that. I have to write something to that, I guess. But anyway, we've got frogs and uniforms and a rhinoceros and armor and with that, let's go ahead and introduce our entries. So, what do we have first?
Absolutely. We have the first one, which I will read, which I posted here, which is Musing Winter's Muse. This is by Way Down Upon Joy. So I'm going to give this a read here. Oh, and by the way, before I do that, I want to say that's why I picked Linus and Lucy, the song, because I figure it's kind of whimsical. And also, since we're getting towards the Christmas season, it's, you know, a Christmassy song, so I thought that would that went well with the theme.
Yes, I think so. Perfect.
Awesome.
Read
awesome.
On.
All right, so let's read here. Again, this is by Way Down Upon Joy, Musing Winter's Muse. Winter's dry and cracking skin, thin iced and ghostly white, her hair like branches reaching out for warmth this cold, dark night. We can't escape her steady stare that shares intention's intent glare. She seems hell-bent to just sit there while we seek warmth's birthright. Our own skin's cracked and drying up like hers with no relief. We shoulder spiders patiently, defying all belief. We weather what will come and go through freezing rain and too much snow, and know that when spring brings her show, we'll sanctify each leaf. We'll watch as spring shares brand new face, retracting warmth once more and giving life to space again. Remove what winter's war. Our painted smiles will widen out. Our eyes will note what's come about. We'll welcome season's clout, no doubt, and celebrate restored. And poem. So let's actually start with you, Bobby. What are your thoughts here?
Well read. Well, this is an interesting piece. It almost looks like she's got coral growing out of her. She looks like some kind of amphibian with coral growing out from her head. But she looks like she has spiders crawling on her shoulders. So I would, the attention to detail on the piece makes mention of the spiders and her cold stare, because you don't see much as far as pupils. From her eyes, it's just very dark, and she does have a very cold stare. So I really like the storytelling in this. We can't escape her steady stare that shares intention's intent glare. She seems hell bent to just sit there while we seek warmth's birthright. I also like the very irregular rhyming scheme. It's got an unusual pattern to it, but it's very pleasing. It's very melodic. And very clever the way it's done. So I really enjoyed this write. I like the storytelling, and I really like the interpretation of the prompt. So I think it's a very nicely done piece.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very interesting prompt, and I think he came up with he or she. I think it might be her. I think it might be a she. I think her name might be Joy. Kind of came up with this interesting character, and yeah, like a kind of a fantasy character. Winter's dry and cracking skin, thin iced and ghostly white. And I like her thought process on here, where I think she was kind of trying to describe the painting, but then went. Yeah, absolutely. She's trying to describe the painting, but then kind of just really kind of went into it. We'll watch the spring. She has brand new face, retracting once more. So she kind of made her almost like a deity of the seasons, which I thought was a really interesting way to go. So I enjoyed this a lot. I thought it was very inventive and great wordplay. So awesome job.
Oh, yes.
That was fun.
Yeah, nicely done. I did enjoy this piece. I was glad it was our first entry. So who do we have
absolutely.
Next?
So next, hold on here, I'm just behind a little bit. I am posting one here by Pee-wee, so you get to read. Yeah, you get to read Pee-wee's.
Okay. Oh, yes. I remember this one. This is a good thing. I'm glad you gave this one to me. This is by Kyle. Death of the Valkyrie, and I'm trying to look what prompts 38 and 40 for those who are looking at the contest prompts. Now through a scanner darkly you see yourself. Smoke, you're looking through just haze and mirrors. The tree starts to choke all the way down to Yggdrasil. Signs the sky took you on this ride made clearer. Sunburned, futility, and none left to trust her. In demise, the world rose up just to see her. Through her final days, through all it kept its luster, doesn't understand how life could yet defeat her. Echoing booms of thunderstorms and gloom sealed up tight, a wisp of smoke on this tragedy. And even now, as it comes down with her doom, divine note delivered in the arms of the Valkyrie. World so sore it's no longer the world you know, lovely things cast into the void with her wings. Where do you go when there's nowhere left to go? Meanwhile, fate warms up her vocal cords to sing, while black skies raining death throughout outside and a bastard aftermath, she looks through your eyes, seems to say that she's leaving today on this tide of twisted lives, propagated the lies and her demise. So here we are, a front row seat to the world's tragedy, world behind world of horrors. It's a world no more. Divine note delivery through death of the Valkyrie. Reaching back, she closes the door to forevermore. End poem.
Excellent. And I do really like Death of the Valkyrie. That's really interesting to me, just the title of it. And I'm guessing, Pee-wee, that he channeled a little bit of Edgar Allan Poe here. I see a little bit of Edgar Allan Poe on here. I'm not sure if that's what he was channeling at this time. But going booms of thunderstorms and gloom, sealed up tight a wisp of smoke on this tragedy. Even now, as it comes down with her doom, divine note delivered in the arms of the Valkyrie. I love rhyming Valkyrie. I don't know. that's a great one to rhyme. It's a hard one to rhyme, and he did a great job. And there's some really great imagery and storytelling that Pee-wee did that I thought was great. So really nice job, Pee-wee. And he used two prompts. He used prompt 38 and 40 for anybody following along. So some really great imagery and feel here. Yeah, and I enjoyed it. You did a fantastic read. What did you think?
I really enjoyed it also. I liked his storytelling. I think the fact that he invoked the Norse mythology. When people hear Valkyrie, I don't know about anybody else, but I immediately think of Wagner and was it the Ring series of his operas where he does a lot of he's got Valkyries in that. But Valkyries were actually Norse. They were Norse mythology. They were the host of female figures who guided the souls to the dead, to Valhalla. And the death of a Valkyrie is an interesting term, an interesting theme, because here these were the warrior maidens who guided the people to Valhalla, but for a Valkyrie to die must have just been a tragic thing. The Valkyries, they're in the events of Ragnarok. If you read that, if you're inclined to read the Norse mythology, anyway, just I like, he's very imaginative. I like the way he took the theme of the prompts and the Valkyrie and wove this really really intricate theme, the intricate story with visual imagery, while black skies raining death through outside and a bastard aftermath, she looks through your eyes, seems to say that she's leaving today on this ride, tide of twisted lives, propagated the lies and her demise. Great storytelling, great visual imagery, great metaphor, just terrific writing. I really enjoyed this piece.
Yeah, absolutely. My son and wife are really into all the mythologies. They can kind of usually name all of them. My son read a ton of them. And then I learned them from them and from the Marvel movies, because it was a whole movie called Thor Ragnarok where they kind of went into a lot of that stuff. And I knew you were going to think of Wagner. I knew you were going to think of that, but my job in life, someday I'm going to get you to start listening to Black Sabbath and AC/DC and Van Halen. That's my jewel. All right.
Iron Man.
Oh, there you go. All right.
See?
You're into it. You know it.
Oh yeah.
Excellent.
Oh yeah. I know Black Sabbath. Believe me, I'm a child of the '60s and '70s.
Oh, there you go. All right. Excellent.
See?
That's right.
There you go. Okay. Yeah. And
right,
I,
cool.
I will spare our audience any more of my vocalizations.
That's okay.
Iron Man, it's a good song. It's got interesting lyrics too. I mean, just because it's heavy metal, you really have to look at the poetry that's in the song, because there's a lot. They have a lot to say in those.
Yeah, you know what they say was interesting. The Black Sabbath, I think, did this really interesting thing where they have this, you know, like the song War Pigs. You know, you listen to just some of the lyrics, and it seems like they're promoting war, but they're not. They're actually talking about the horrors of it and all that. And there's a song called that's without Ozzy. It's with Dio, called The Mob Rules. And it's interesting because they just keep the mob rules, and it seems like they're promoting that. But the line before that is, if you listen to fools, the mob rules. So they're very,
yeah.
Black Sabbath actually talks a lot about peace and love and, you know, coming together and all this stuff. But the way they do it in the heavy metal, like if you're just listening to the catchphrases, you can take it the other way. So they're actually interesting. I'll give them that. All right. So we have, I'm a little bit behind here. I was actually getting into everything. I'm a little behind, but I think I'm going to post this one here by Gerald Green. And I will say before we do this, I believe we have a SoundCloud, and I was saved from above because I
Woo-hoo!
Did not see the SoundCloud. I thought it was there, but a beautiful angelic voice came on and told me that they had saved us. So thank you, angels from above, for getting this SoundCloud for us.
Technology angels have saved us again.
The technology angels found the SoundCloud for us, so let's sit back and hopefully listen to Gerald here.
Autocrat.
If I'm wrong, here
written in red by Gerald Green. He managed men with dark, contempt. Achieving productivity, replacing thought with increased output, meeting quotas on each shift. Anger was his largest tool, his voice resounding through the shop. Welders welding, grinders grinding, all in sync with frown and glare. The day he became its president, fear became its common core, shouting and consistent harassment to subjugate and prod the weak. I saw the monster thrive and grow, become vindictive, mean and low, soaring profits into pockets, making light of what he did. He had become a barnyard rooster, self-absorbed with ownership, seeking all the pomp and glory one could get from those who serve. Every day there was a crisis, something new for him to solve, raising stress and feeding ego of the one who nurtured fear. End poem.
Awesome job, Gerald. Thank you very much for the SoundCloud. I'm so glad that we didn't miss that. For those who don't know, Gerald has a great YouTube page. You can follow him and listen to all of his poetry he has there. And then I also follow him on Instagram. So he's got some great stuff there. And you can actually see him. He's on his he has his camera on, and you can see him live read that. So thank you very much. I like where he went with this and the proudness, but he didn't just get – so the for those of you who can't see the picture, it's a rooster basically, like all dressed up in an old early 1800s kind of formal wear with some mountains in the background. But he's really concentrating on this picture, and he kind of took it, in my opinion, to a to an interesting place, not only just being the pride of it, but almost taking him to a darker place, to me kind of – being the, he became a barnyard rooster, self-absorbed with ownership, seeking all the pomp and glory one could get from those who serve. And what came to mind to me was kind of businessmen of the day, or business people of the day. And I've been in businesses now for 35 years. I've been in corporations, and I've seen it happen where nice people, that I'll talk to all the time, and they do show signs of caring, and they have their humanity. We can save a little money if we do this, and they fire, and hundreds of people are fired, or they move jobs or whatever. And I understand that businesses have to do those things sometimes, but I have seen people kind of, in my opinion, lose a little bit of humanity when they start not thinking about the people's lives that they can actually affect, being in corporations and having power. And I'm kind of seeing a little bit there. I saw the monster thrive and grow, become a vindictive, mean and low, soaring profits into pockets, making light of what he did. I have seen that with people, and it's too bad that you see people kind of, in my opinion, sell themselves out a little, and I see it everywhere, because the more power you have, even in business, you are everybody that's below you. You affect their lives. You have control over them. You have so much control over what they do. You can hire and fire people, and it's a responsibility, and you have to always think of the human aspect, I think. And again, I understand the business aspects of things, but there's certainly a human element. So that's what I thought with the autocrat that Gerald did. Besides his fantastic read, So what did you get out of this, there, Bobby?
Well, I like the fact that he took a rooster, the image of the rooster, which very grand looking rooster, very magnificent comb, very regal looking, ruling the barnyard, and he's taken the precept that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, or as Lord Acton said, an observation that a person's sense of morality lessens as his or her power increases. And to make someone if they rule the barnyard, they are basically, they've got sway over everyone or everything. And this tends to affect their thinking. And the way he's used a rooster who definitely rules the barnyard, at least his portion of it, with the, his brood and his hens and what have you. And there's no room for a second rooster. It just doesn't happen. The characterization of the character has become tainted with the power. He's become a barnyard rooster, self-absorbed with ownership, seeking all the pomp and glory one could get from those who serve. Every day there's a crisis, something new for him to solve, raising stress and feeding ego of the one who nurtures fear. So it's almost like it's a self fulfilling prophecy that this rooster, the owner, the ruler of the barnyard, creates the crises that he then proceeds to solve. So this is wonderfully imaginative, and the philosophy that has been woven through this is just, I think this is just a magnificent write, really insightful as to the character of someone who rules the barnyard or rules the corporate roost, as it happened. And it's funny that this rides on. Last night I watched at a friend's recommendation a film called Bombshell, which is about it's part fact and part fiction. It's fact based, or it's inspired by fact, and it's about Fox News and the women anchors and the people who owned Fox and the people who ran it, and how the man who ran it basically just became corrupted with his own power and was finally forced out because some women had the courage to step forward and say, you know, this is how he's behaving. So it was interesting.
Yeah, I think I might have heard this quote from somebody on one of the shows, but there's no such thing as a moral billionaire. And the meaning is that if you have $1 billion, you don't need that, and you're going to give a lot of it away till you don't have $1 billion anymore, because it's the moral thing to do, because you just have just too much money, you know. And I do believe that, you know. For example, I love Pink Floyd's one of my favorite bands, and I'm a drummer, so I grew up. Nick Mason's one of my idols, but he has cars worth $40-50 million, and that's great. But he has dozens of them, and in my opinion, it's like there's so much good he could do with those. It just seems insane to me that's just sitting in a house somewhere.
That's like Jerry Seinfeld in his Porsche collection.
Yeah, and I get, and I'm totally in favor of the American dream. I get all that. And if he wants to buy a bunch of cars, but them just sitting there for years and years and years when they could do so much good, especially in what's going on in the world now, it just I think it's just out of touch. But anyway,
I see your fatal flaw is the application of logic. It'll never work.
Exactly. But who's to say I was a billionaire? Maybe I'm just jealous. Who knows? Probably all lose a little bit of touch.
Okay.
Tell you what, world. Make me a billionaire. Let's see what happens. Well, how's that? That's my challenge to the universe. All right. So next, I don't know whose turn it is, but I'm going to let you read this one because I think it's much better, the female voice, since it is a poem by Betty Page. So I'm sure it is meant for a female to read.
Now, don't forget, we skipped over I Am the Walrus.
We did, and I only skipped over that because he said he might call in, so I will get to it in a little bit. I'm just giving him some time to see if he does actually call in. If he doesn't, I'll make sure we get to it tonight. Yes.
Outstanding. Well, we have Betty Page with Little Minx and her Sanrio chain here. Shimmering fairy, she's swift, so sly as a fox in all her mischief. Wears masquerade masks, hides wicked secrets from all, has a vicious bite. Mystical goddess wanders deep through the dark forests, searching for her prey. Rules these ancient lands, her sword wields razor-sharp blades, holds secret magic. Best not to cross her. Heart's been ripped out long ago by her own two hands. Demons adore her, for she makes love so sweetly, gazing into their eyes. indulge in her curves, neath apocalyptic skies, taste sweet, pure starlight. Her fangs fiercely bite, seals vindictively your fate in eternal hell. End poem.
Awesome read. And I really enjoyed this one by Betty. You know, she really took the character, I think, to an interesting place.
Oh, yes.
And to me, I think she went a little deep into the, in which I enjoyed, into the dangers of succumbing to lust, where, you know, this person who's vindictive, but also uses the sexuality to, you know, to get at people, right? Demons adore her because she makes love so sweetly, but then her fangs will fiercely bite, seals vindictiveness into your fate, so she can basically seduce you into your fate, which I thought was really interesting. So this is a picture of a beautiful nymph, but she made this character kind of very evil and vindictive, and somebody who is going out to entrap people. And I thought it was really well done, but still very beautifully written. So this is one of my favorites by Betty. I thought she did an awesome job with this.
I agree. And I think she did a splendid job.
Yeah. And
she
did reading it.
Job. Thank you. And I like that she took she went in the direction that you see sometimes, that she took something that looks pretty sweet and innocent, but she found the malevolence in it, and she played that up, how evil can be disguised as sweetly in satin robes. And she's and it's interesting because in the image it says Tinkerbell Night Feeder, and at this pixie's gesture. At this pixie's feet is this bloody carcass, or what's left of it. So she's like, she's taken the interpretation and kind of really gone to the dark side with this sweet-looking little pixie. So I really like her. She's always very imaginative. Her Senryu chains are always just great storytelling, very economical writing, and I think she's told a wonderful story on this one too. She just you look at this sweet little a fairy, and you best beware.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, she does. She's a great imagery. She's a great poet. Really is. I want to welcome Aira Mundell, Amy, to the board. So hey, Amy, thanks for listening in on the board. We appreciate that. We'll get to your poem shortly. But right now, I'm going to post one by Writin' Stuffs, and I will give that a read. This is called The Life of Any Party. Princess Martina Matilda Mariana Mouse held the most wonderful parties in any house, with the finest imported Cheshire and Brie, served up with green olives and black tea. In her finest satins and imported lace, this fair princess with a divine face would serve her guests with eclastic glee, though if you prefer, you could have Chablis. Truly, she told the most wonderful jokes, sure to split the sides of any bloke. The room did light up when she arrived, her fondue she flavored with the finest chives. Fresh homemade breads were dipped in her pot. Maestro Mouse always dripped cheese on his escot. She now provides bibs for their dining ease when eating her luscious liquid cheese. Her Asiago will tickle your empty tum-tum. Sometimes she serves Jamaican spiced rum. There's Chantel, Bell, Blue, and Havadi, Stilton, Provolone, Reggiano, and Testori. Her goal in life is to ultimately see everyone in the world enjoying great cheese. And there's nothing like her truffled delights when she serves at parties on Saturday nights. A most generous hostess, Martina takes pride in serving the disabled at the curbside. No one ever goes hungry with Martina around. She also gives etiquette lessons in town. End poem. And what a whimsical fun. I mean, she not only took the prompt great, which is just a picture of a mouse with a big giant fork and a bunch of cheese and things around, but she took the whimsicality of the title of that you said and just made a beautifully fun poem, which, of course, I could not help but think of the cheese shop sketch of Monty Python. I know this had nothing to do with that, but when she started naming off cheese,
yes,
that's all I could think about. I'm sorry. That just came to mind. But this is really great, a parable. You could see this as a little children's rhyme. And just so beautifully. I mean, I could see this in any classic children's book, and I defy anybody to find a classic just tale or rhyme from anywhere that's better than this. You know, everything was so well done and so well rhymed, and I love the name Princess Martina Matilda Mariana Mouse.
Yes, great alliteration.
Great alliteration, and just so much fun. And that's what I certainly write a lot of philosophical things, but I actually just one of my last poems I wrote for actually Sinner and Saint was just a fun, goofy poem. And it definitely had some hidden meanings in there for the prompt, but I'm a big fan of just making, you know, these things, just making kind of lyrics that are just fun to listen to, and they're what I call is like the musicality of poetry, where they're mm-hmm. they're just interesting, and you just want to kind of read them, and they're fun to listen to, and they're interesting just in the word choices themselves. And that is absolutely an art form in itself that is different than anything else and hard to do. And I think she just did a beautiful job. I mean, I really like this one a lot. It was fun to read and just enjoyable the whole way through. So yeah, that was great job writing stuffs. And what were your thoughts there?
This was my favorite prompt. I don't know why, but it was my favorite prompt. Clearly, this could evolve into a small children's book because she's created a character. She's given a backstory. It's wonderful storytelling. The rhyme is smooth and melodious. She uses wordplay. This is a superb piece, and again, very apt adaptation to a children's rhyme. But I think as far as capturing the prompt, it's incomparable job of creating the story and the piece around the image of the Princess Mouse with the cheese fork and all of the wonderful things around her. So in her grand gown and in her little hat. I mean, it is whimsical. It's just very whimsical, and it's just a very pleasing read and storytelling. I really enjoyed this piece.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I could actually see the painting being drawn based on the poem. You know, that's how well I think she actually did the did the painting justice. So great job with that. Absolutely. All right. I think I'm skipping around a little bit here tonight because, again, we're waiting for possibly somebody calling in. I'm not sure who he's going to or not. But since Amy Aramundel has joined us, I think we'll skip over to hers she's on the board. And you get the honor of reading it, Bobby.
Of course.
I just posted it here.
Of course I do. It's only right. I'll channel Amy. Okay, we have. Oh, yeah, this was one of my other, I really, for some reason, took to this one. I'm glad she wrote to it. The glare of time. And all the world was filled with clocks, adorned on every street, glaring down the milling crowds, without a date to greet. They ogled at the oglers and judged those with no goal, the ones without a fixed intent or just out for a stroll. Excuse me. The watchful eyes of London's time perused all those who passed, staring with oppressive sighs all at all who break the caste. It's 5 o'clock, the bongs would say, with glaring, booming voice, booming force, comfortably in their authority, like a teacher on its course. The chimes would set the heart to jump, to startle from their glaze, to set about on rabid feet and hop the urban maze. Their errands all just crashed to mind, and the panic settled in, and if the clocks would smile or laugh, their pace might make them grin. Running now to catch closing shops or off to catch a bus, matching all the other ones who never broke their rush. Contented now that all were fleet, the clocks relaxed their views, settling upon the streets awash with rainy hues. But then their gaze fell to the road where one man stood alone, still upon the shifting sands of all within their zone. Shadows flickered, streetlights shimmered, and all the light did dance. Even mist and cobblestones moved as if entranced. Yet he alone, amidst it all, seemed held outside that night, still in muscle, clothes and hat, and blocking out the light. As if he'd stepped into a ball and refused all chance to waltz, stood upon the ballroom floor in complete and utter halt, a wallflower front and center, but taking it all in, refusing to pick up the pace or participate in the ball. The clocks glared down, disgruntled, with no one who's so sedate. Yet no matter how they bellied, the man seemed never late. He wandered on so casually as if he did not hear, tipped his hat to all the world and anyone who'd rush near. And in his stroll, he watched the dance, the foxtrot and the swirl, reflections of the earth shine by, the way the mist did curl. The only one upon the street who saw what those clocks saw, as he carried on so freely and the bells bonked evermore. End poem.
Excellent read. And I thought this was great. I really enjoyed it. Again, another one that I think the picture itself, it described it so well, I think the picture itself could have been drawn based on this lovely poem here. And it was really a beautiful story. I love the personification of the clocks as having kind of power. And I also think there was some really deep thoughts in here, which I think Amy does a lot, has multiple layers, where it is talking about the how much we are controlled by time, right, and the clocks control us. I actually do remember as a kid, you know, there was a time, right, that, you know, you didn't have a cell phone with you, so you didn't always know where if you didn't carry a watch, you had to go figure out what time it was. I remember as a kid literally just asking people, hey, can you, you know, trying to find somebody that had a watch. Do you know what time it is? Do you know what time? They're like asking strangers on the street if they knew what time it was, because I never really carried a watch. But in the cities, I remember as a kid seeing the big clocks around and kind of noticing them, because I would look to see what time it was, and I noticed them, and I thought it was interesting, and a lot of people don't notice them anymore. So I thought that imagery just brought something personal for me. And again, the controlling of the clocks that we have, the way that it controls our lives, the way that time controls our lives, even when we sleep. You know, we think that we're lying down in bed, but at least for myself, I'm always thinking, okay, what time is it? Am I going to get enough sleep tonight? I have to get up in the morning. Like we're just constantly aware of time. And to have this character now, to me, when I saw the picture, it seemed more like the guy was obsessed with the clocks. But I really like Amy's take on this, where he's not. He's kind of controlling time himself, like the clocks. He's almost defying them. And the clocks are getting angry because he's not in bed like everybody else, right? He's defying them to say, I'm not going to let time control me. So I thought all that was just so interesting. This is a lot of fun and a lot of different layers. So really, really great job. It was great. What did you think while you were reading it, Bobby?
Oh, I agree. I think this piece particularly is very layered. piece, very cerebral, in that I think, and here's where I'm going to go scientific on everybody, I think this approaches Einstein's explanation of time being a human contrivance and actually just being a persistent illusion, where because people cannot control time, they've invented artificialities to try and at least monitor it. And here she's created a character who runs afoul of that. And says, let's see, I'm looking for the particular stanza. I like that. This is a lengthy write, but I really like the storytelling. He wandered on so casually as if he did not hear, tipped his hat to all the world and any who rushed near. On the previous stanza, the clocks glared down disgruntled with one who's so sedate. Yet no matter how they belled, the man seemed never late. He's basically contemptuous of the clocks trying to force time on human populace, and he's contemptuous of that. He's beyond it. His stroll as he watched the dance, the fox and the twirl reflects of the earth that shine by the way the mist did swirl. He just basically, and the only one upon that street who saw what those clocks saw as he came, as he carried on so freely and the bells bonged evermore. Basically, he has broken the code on time, and the clocks are annoyed because here's a human who is not being ruled by them. And here's this individual who is, he's above the clocks. He's dolce far niente, how sweet to do nothing. He does nothing. He does not let time run him. And I really love the deep philosophy that's threaded through this. I mean, this is a very cerebral write, and I really enjoyed her interpretation of the prompt. I think it was bloody brilliant.
Absolutely. I'm a little bit obsessed with time. I have been for a while, but really been thinking about it the past couple of years, especially with poetry. When I write, I usually am kind of thinking, and so I've written a lot of poetry on time, literally just trying to think of it different ways and figure it out, and it's very interesting. I think she did a great job, very inspiring. Awesome job.
Yeah, it was terrific. I really enjoyed this piece. I really enjoyed her interpretation of the prompt. I really did. I thought there was a lot of thought put into this piece.
Absolutely. All right, cool. I will read the next one, and I need to figure out other obsessions. I do like genealogy, and Michael McDermott is actually my mother's maiden name, and I'm trying to figure out if I'm related to this gentleman, because that's part of my family that's not there. I actually just found out that I'm related to the, believe it or not, as fate would have it, the famous poet Anne Sexton is actually a distant old relative of mine. I just found out, which I thought was interesting. So I'm curious whenever I see family names like McDermott, I have to find out if this guy is.
See, I'm free of
distant.
That. I'm an orphan.
Oh, there you go. Are you really?
Yes, I am really. I have no surviving family. My father was an orphan. My grandmother came from Poland, and we have no. I have no links to, you know, whoever was left behind. So I'm a dinosaur. I'm it. I'm Chingachgook, if you understand.
Yeah, we actually know. My grandfather was Frank McDermott, who we know very, very little about. My wife's obsessed with genealogy. She traces our families back all over the place. But
good for her.
The McDermott
That's
side.
That's important.
It is. It's very interesting, and the McDermott side we know nothing about. So that's the interesting part. Is he was kind of an orphan only child, and kind of sort of So that interests me. Anyway.
Well, I found my father's adoption papers after my mother died, going through all her paperwork, found out that his adopted parents had changed his name after he was adopted. And so his name was Harry Joseph Dignam when he was my father, but before he was adopted, he was Edward Kenneth Ford. So we have no idea, you know, didn't go anywhere with that. Yeah. Isn't that kind of bizarre? Yeah. So
my wife found out she's related to the Bushes, but it's not related. There's a common ancestor that literally came off one of the Mayflowers. So it's not really related. It's way back. Amy, by the way,
so thank you. Myself. I'm sorry.
There you go.
Bad joke.
Amy said, thank you very much for your awesome comments. Got it exactly. So that's great. And thank you, Pee-wee. And Pee-wee said, I'm some kind of relative of Zane Grey. So it's interesting. See, I'm actually a relative of Zane. I'm a relative of Zane E. But so that's where that's out there.
I'm totally irrelevant. How's that?
That's right. I'm irrelative. That's right. Anyway, so I'm mentioning all this craziness because Michael McDermott is our next poet up here. And I get to read him, and I'm going to fantasize that he is a long-lost relative of mine and read this here.
Whatever trips your trip.
Exactly. It makes me happy to fantasize about that, to think about that. This is called A Winter Hunger's Tale, Prompt 7 for those following along, by Michael McDermott. Those squirrels in our neighborhood, overlords of the old village pond, spend their days in search of food, together united in a family bond. Red Raphael, he was an empty biscuit tin, while eager Edgar was a deep water well. Older brother's hunger was for shiny stuff. The others read, so had moral fables to tell. One wild midwinter, there wasn't enough to feed all village squirrels in need. Big brother traveled far away to dine. A prosperous city catered to his greed. Younger brother chose to remain at home, to seek new sources of needed feed. His efforts to overcome this seasonal plight helped his famished friends succeed. In the city, still like others of his kind, Raphael now forages in the glutton's bin, while his caring heart and curious mind brought peace to Edgar, savior of his kin. End poem. And Bobby, let's actually start with you.
I like this. It's interesting. I was looking at the prompt and I was wondering how he where he got the story. But you know, it's sometimes people see something in a prompt that none of the rest of us can see, simply because everything's filtered through your own personal experiences. But I like his storytelling. Excuse me. Like a storytelling, big brother traveled far away to dine, prosperous city catered to his greed, younger brother chose to remain at home to seek new sources of needed feed. Great storytelling. I mean, he's got, he's developed characters, he's got us invested in them, and the ending, well, his caring heart and curious mind brought peace to Edgar, savior of his kin. It has a lovely ending. He's just got this troop of squirrels that he's woven this wonderful tale around. It's a pun aside, squirrel's tale. I thought it was delightful, and I really enjoyed his storytelling and his visual imagery.
Yeah, me too. No, it was really fun and. It's interesting, so far there's been some few kind of like, I don't want to say kid themes, but, you know, like parables or fable kind of themes. And you can see this here, and it was really great. And he got, you know, there was this was the first prompt that we had was the winter woman. So he must have just kind of, you know, thought and went off and imagined these squirrels kind of gathering food. And I really love the play on words of succeed. So I helped his famished friends succeed. So that was actually pretty inventive. I enjoyed that a lot.
Clever.
That was fun. That was very clever. Yeah, I enjoyed that, Michael. And you know, interesting names we've had this whole time. Eager Edgar, Red Raphael, for the names of the squirrels was fun. But this is fun and very well written. The rhyming was good, and it was really, really interesting. You know, so great job. I enjoyed it, Michael, a lot.
Yeah, Michael writes
and
well.
He does. He does. He writes very well. So we now
okay,
are
who's
going
that next?
To get. Yes, yeah, so everybody get excited because we have SoundCloud from Poetic Picasso.
Oh!
And I'm posting it here, so if we can play
highlight
that.
Highlight of the evening, especially exactly. Since we only have 30 minutes left.
That's right.
Can you believe it? It's 11:30.
Coming up shortly here.
Drops of erotic honey seep from the moisture of your vast old lips, so roused like an exotic bumblebee thirsty. I sip from the edges of your lustful petals. My wings buzz as I enter the mouth of your amber seduction, so wet as the orgasmic taste of your erogenous part. Your lips contract with each shiver as I sate my thirst, exploring the naughty pleasures of my floral fetish. Deeper my tongue travels and is full of sticky honey, the kind that stays in my tongue with every lick. To your inner lips beg, and my honey dipper is dry.
All right, Frank, thank you very much. And this is, sorry, Frank. This is, thank you, Frank, very much. Great read. And this is the exact reason why we have our show is 18 plus. Because we let us go out. But this is so fantastic and erotic for Frank. And how did I know when I saw this painting that this is the one that Frank was going to pick? I don't know why. How did I know that Frank would pick this one?
I have no idea.
I don't know. But well, great read, man. Who can take sexuality and make it so tastefully sensual? I mean, this is you know, nobody can do it. As well as Frank can, let me tell you. And it's he just did such a great job. You know, the classic pairing of, flowers to the female body, and just a really great job. So awesome, Frank. And I think we might have a guest star on the show right now.
I think so. Who could that be?
Hi, everybody. Hi, Bobby.
Hi,
Daniel.
Hey, hi. Oh, how nice. How nice of you to join us.
Sorry, I'm with my mom on Saturday, so that's why I've been calling in late. But I try to get home in time to...
Well, I'm glad you're doing. We're glad to have whatever time you can spare. Thank you.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're happy to have you.
Oh, goodness. I hope your mom didn't hear that one. That's not a good one to say to your parents.
No, because she was coming to hang up.
I'm sit around.
Yeah, she would have wanted to know what this was about.
Okay. So what do you think?
I thought this was delicious, very erotic. The picture is erotic as it is, and you can see the floral is just dripping full of delicious pollen and delicious honey. And, you know, you can just see this because that's what I was doing today. I was out in the front. I was watering and I was watching the bees and the butterflies buzz about and everything. And it just, this is just so deeply sensuous and rich. It just like it says, your lips contact with each shiver as I satiate my thirst, exploring the naughty pleasures of my floral fetish. Deeper my tongue travels, and it's full of sticky honey. Oh, my goodness. It's just, He just, each line just goes into the next, and you just keep reading and reading and reading until his tongue with every lick, till your inner lip beg. And my honey, temper is dry.
You have to hold you down.
I doubt that it'll ever be dry, but he'll just go to the next flower. So
time to hold you down.
I looked at those pictures. My favorite still was the little mouth. I didn't have time to write for it, but if I did, it would have been that little mouse because I fell in love with it. Beautiful artwork.
Yeah, mine did too. Yeah. Yeah. Frank, I swear to God, has the gift. He could make my shopping list for the grocery store erotic. He could turn that into such a tale. I swear, he has a gift for expressing himself, and he does it with such creativity and such taste. I mean, there's nothing puerile about Frank's writing at all. It's erotic, it's exciting, but it's never tawdry. Which I think that's a real gift as far as I'm concerned. So, and then there's no first one falls into that category of being definitely erotic.
Mm-hmm. It was delicious.
I had a feeling when I put that prompt out there that Frank was going to latch onto that one.
Yeah, I don't know if Frank has I don't know if he has a book. I'm looking at his page right now. I don't see any books. He should really love to see him post a book of just love. I know he writes other things as well, too, but book of just, you know, love, sensual poems, I think would be fantastic.
Yeah,
romantic poems. He does everything good. You know, he's written some of the horror stuff he does is good, and the philosophical.
I think we all agree this is his forte.
Definitely. All right, so we're all going to take a cold shower here and relax a little bit and come back down.
And I'm going to say, "Oh, baby,
yeah."
And, all right, so Randy G had said he might try to join, but I don't think he'll be able to. So I am going to put his up. And Lou, if you could give that a read, it's on the board now.
That's a good one.
Great.
Okay. I Am the Walrus by Randy G. Bill Mayer has treated us with his artwork, posing with a smile, perhaps a little smirk, offering characters in colorful costumes, military uniforms or dresses with plumes, animals in a variety wearing human clothes. How he got his inspiration? Heaven knows. The women's face is surrounded by flowers. The intricate detail must have taken hours. The rhino in armor seems a bit redundant. Clever, fanciful, but not exactly Rembrandt. Painting open season, a goose with a gun. Mayer style says he must be having fun. His paintings call for a closer inspection, offered in his work, a time of reflection. Mr. Mustache, and my question after all, I know he's the walrus. Is he John or Paul in poem?
Awesome, fun little read, and that's, we've had a few that have taken the whimsicality of this and had fun with it, which is great. So he did the title to the prompt, but he obviously did. He kind of just talked about all of the paintings.
Yes, he did.
Great, Bobby. Let's go with you.
Yeah, I like he did. He did do a excuse me. He did do a an interesting comprehensive of the different prompts, animals and variety. Wearing human clothes, how he got his inspiration, heaven knows. and women's faces surrounded by flowers. The intricate detail must have taken hours. Beautiful. I mean, that particular stanza, I mean, just stand on its own. Most all of them can. But the rhino in armor seems a bit redundant. I like that. Clever, passable. Exactly, Rembrandt. He had fun with this, which is really he made it enjoyable. It's a great whimsical read, and his ending. I know he's the walrus. Is he John or Paul? Very mm-hmm. The whole thing, start to finish, is very clever.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was a lot of fun, and I like people taking the whimsicality and just having fun with it, and you know we've. There's certainly been some poems with deep meanings, which have always been great, but I always enjoy the ones that are just fun. You know, I've said that many times before about, you know, about all different art forms. You know, art is great. Every form of art is great to really express yourself. You can get so deep in things, but there's an art form of just having fun with things, and I'm really glad that a lot of the and it's hard to do. It can be hard to do that type of that poetry, and we've had some great poetry that's just been you know, fun little takes on the prompts, and I love that stuff. I'm a big fan. Louie did an awesome job reading it. What'd you think?
I liked it. You know, because I you think of the Beatles, you know, I Am the Walrus, so you know right away that comes to my mind, and then you see he caught the attitude of the walrus, I think. And I loved all I loved the rhyme scheme. I loved how it blended. I loved how he talked about several of the pictures in here. You know, those, like your hit says, animals, which there were so many animals in a variety of clothing surrounded by flowers and intricate. And then I liked how he talked about the rhino, and that his pictures aren't exactly a Rembrandt, but basically that he must have had, you know, for me, when I looked at these and the way you react when you look at all the various pictures, there is a reaction to this. And, you know, you can't help but find yourself endeared to the pictures that are on here. And then to look at the detail like he did and how much fun he must have had, you know, painting and drawing all these images that came to his mind, and it was thoroughly enjoyable. I liked it from the first stanza to the last. Clever.
Excellent. Yeah, and Amy said, fun poem, well read, and agreed with Bobby that she liked the rhino line, so thank you for that, Amy. All right, let's continue on. I'm not sure whose turn it is, but I think this would be good for Bobby to read, so I'm going to post this here for you. Pick me, yes. The one in the front with your hand up there. You get to read.
I like that. So Amy called me Bibby. I like that.
That's right.
I've never had that misspelling before. I like it.
Bibby's good. Bibby. All right. So this is one by Thomas.
All righty. We
have
her bad side. Oh, Thomas. My boy Thomas. Okay. Choices are easy. Consequences never light. The future unpredictable. Flight of fancy. Expense that's only secure when you're finally alight. Luck is not dependable. Just when you think you're hot, the table grows cold. Just when you are sure you got it, you find the guy next to you has all the gold. Life's not fair. Mm. So why are you the proof? Ask the muse who is your mistress about the matron who patrols the halls, the disciplinarian who evens the odds, balances the books, the one even the gods don't wish to call. She casts a shadow like a jail door swinging shut. Light might be boundless, but around her keeps its mouth shut. So whisper your prayers, shake your dice, pray this lady won't darken your night. Bad luck ain't superstition. It isn't a matter of math or some other complication. You might say it is her affection, a kiss that scorns in the worst way. Her dedication could mean death, would only be a way to betray. Remember, her highs are your lows. She will find you wherever you go. Walk softly. Practice good deeds. If the gods love you, then you could be invisible to her petulance instead of prey. End poem.
Thank you very much, Bobby. Yeah, and I've been saying, you know, a lot of this stuff has been whimsical, but the one that Tom picked, the painting, I think is not very whimsical. There's definitely some deep thoughts
dark.
And introspective with that painting, and he did a great job with it. Lou, let's start with you.
Yeah, you know, I really enjoyed where he took this. It made me look deeper into the picture. It's almost like a dreamlike state, like she has wings that possibly she can put on, but if you look closer at the picture, she's picking up all these snakes, and all these snakes, I don't know,
yeah.
Either they're dropping yeah. out or they're going yeah. up. And then she has like a pin in her hand. So I really liked, you know, where he says, you know, that, you know, she's be careful what you're doing because she can see the alleyways to life. And obviously, I'm thinking she's able to move that way. And that she picks up the snakes or lets go of the snakes. Either way, she's carrying them. And, you know, so she's casting this shadow, you know, about how she was treated. And to me, it's like kind of like, well, she balances the book and her life was in balance due to some type of death. And now she stalks those who possibly are lying on their books of monies that they have and the, you know, all the dark things that, you know, because if you watch a lot of this period time pieces, there was a lot of dark alleys and families gambling their money, their wooden dowries, and, you know, just saying you better be careful, you know, that eventually you better hope that she doesn't darken your night. Bad luck is superstitions. It's a matter of math or some other complication. And that's the way I take it. She's going to balance the evil that you do in your life, highs or lows. So it says make sure that kind of also reminded me of a Santa Claus, you know, you better be good or something bad's going to happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you, Lou. Bobby, what are your thoughts over there? You read it great.
Well, I thank you. The title of the piece is Bad Luck. So he's taken the subtleties in the piece, which when I posted it, I noticed that the dragonfly wings are you catch them right away, but then you see as you look at the study of the piece, you see all the snakes either emerging from her gown or converging on her gown, as Lou said, you know, it could be either way. But I like the way he said her bad side, and he's taken and given, he's personified the bad luck in here, and he's given us all the different ways that you know, she could complicate your life, and the way that her forte is your misfortune, and he's done it very artfully and very cleverly. So I really like this. I always like Thomas's writing. He's a little bit he's got an interesting point of view. I've had chats with him. He's a glass half empty. The glass leaks and the water's contaminated. but he does it with
yep.
such, he does it so artfully that he can't help but enjoy it.
Yeah.
He's I know, I think he's a child of the 60s, so I could totally see him at like the love-in protests in the 60s and stuff. I think he was one of those guys that I could
yeah.
see that. So God bless him. We love Thomas. All right, cool. So what time is it? Ooh, we got time for one or two more. So I am gonna post. Time flies when you're in an airplane, or when you're having fun, right? So let's. I just
yes,
read an interesting airplane fact today.
There's a
yes.
question: if the canaries are flying while they're in the
yes.
airplane, do they contribute to the weight?
Ah, that's interesting. I don't know. Do they?
That would depend on how heavy their cages are.
Actually, I don't know the scientific reason. I'm sure there is, but I did read that as you're flying, you lose a couple of pounds. So, which makes sense to me. So, and then when you land again, you gain it back. But you want the canaries to keep flying, because if they're not flying, then that's that, you know, whole canary in a coal mine thing. So you always want your canaries flying anyway. All right. I just posted one by Captain Kerr. I'm going to give that a read. This is called
What
Under
a Cool
Oak
Name.
Yeah, I love that name. Under Oak and Willow Cover. On torrid winds dip and sweep, and drink from cups of clove and heather. Curled will sleep and wake on wings from heaven. With eyes as dark as midnight breath, a bowl of truffles scent the air. A frilly ruff drapes round her neck. Trooped butterflies braid her hair. A crimson lip slightly dips when she feels the tug and tease. Manicured toes and fingertips painted like summer's eve. But her thoughts are elsewhere. Riding mounds and grassy swells, the royal steed gallops in steep through the woods and greening dells, snorting with heated breath. The mouth of the cavern opens wide under oak and willow cover. The butterflies scatter to live their lives as she takes a secret lover. End poem. And one of the things I noticed tonight, too, was the rhyming. And I definitely think that this artist brings that whimsicality of rhyme. I can see why there's been a lot of that tonight as opposed to free verse. The artwork lends itself to that. So great job. And this is a lot of fun. And I'm going to go back and start again with you, Lulu. Lulu, what did you think?
Okay, I really thought you did a fabulous job in reading Captain Kerr's poem. I really loved the imagery of this. I loved how he captured that look on her face, like, you know, I don't want to be here. You know, they're painting my toenails, and you know the etiquette that was carried out at that time was just demanding, and every single I and T had to be dotted in looks and in writing, everything, the whole life of these women. And I liked how he brought that up, you know, that here she's sitting there, you know, they're manicuring, you know, how they do, they completely dress you and undress you, put your shoes on. And I really liked how he brought it, oh, you know, because you could feel the nuance of this age where, you know, manicured toes and fingertips painted like summer's eve. But what I also liked was that he caught what some of these women, even though they played the game in appearance, what they did behind doors was different. Many of them did not want to get married to, you know, these old men, because that's basically what they were raised for, raised to be beautiful virgins and marry some rich, ugly old man that was 50 years older than them and provide him with the heir. But I liked how he caught the personality and says where she would rather be. She would rather be riding a horse in the woods and releasing all the butterflies in her hair, so that she could be with the person that she loved. I really like this. And I probably made too long of a comment, but because I really like the poem.
No, I think you're right. I think it's interesting. And for those who can't see the prompt, you know, the girl has all butterflies in her hair, but you would think that that would be like a positive thing. It's always, you know, in nature and all, but she has this look of like, what the hell is going on? Why am I here? I don't want to be
here.
Yeah,
I don't want to be here. Yeah.
I don't want to be here. And it's that one line in the middle, but her thoughts are elsewhere. And, you know, she, like you said, she's being all made up. She's being dolled up for the world to, you know, for the world's pleasure, right? Not for hers. And she's other places. She's off riding mounds, grassy swells, and, you know, all of this. And, yeah, I'm seeing a lot more now. I'm noticing more. I know the world still has a lot of places to go. I'm noticing a lot more equality now, and just because I'm getting older, you can see it, and it's really interesting. And to me, good the way the world is going. You know, when I was, you know, first starting a business, you didn't see women, minorities, different, or you know, in business, right? When I first started in the business world, you just didn't really see that. And nowadays, like I was just looking for a business, and businesses are, there's so many, you know, women-owned businesses, and to me, it's just like, I see it a lot now where people aren't really thinking about your gender, your race, your religion, any of those things anymore. It's just, you know, your qualifications. And when I still remember when I was younger, I think everybody knows I've said I played drums, and there was this guy who was a mentor of mine, a karate and drum mentor. And I remember him saying when I was younger, you know, that there were certain instruments women shouldn't play. And there was a mentality of that. And I was like, why? And I see so many phenomenal women drummers now. And I'm just so glad that's those stereotypes. I know you guys are probably thinking that there's a lot of the opposite still. I get that out there. There's a lot of still prejudice against things, but I'm definitely seeing signs of, you know, people being able to just do what their talents are and people just being the best for their job and everything being open now to everybody, as opposed to things where just, you know, there's only certain things men can do. There's only certain things women can do. I see a lot of differences in that. Like I said, as a drummer, I'm seeing so many fantastic, you know, young women drummers and guitar players and musicians, where it's, you know, in rock and roll, other places, it was much more of a man's world. And, that's what I'm thinking with that. I'm sorry, I kind of went off a little bit too, but I just think it's an important thing of equality that he shows in here, and I think it's an important topic. So, as there's two women on that were with me here today, I don't know if you agree with me or not, but those are my thoughts. So
enjoying your thoughts.
The silence.
And Bobby,
do you agree with me, or you're like pissed off at me and like, what's this guy talking about? So
no,
I don't know which one it is.
I'm scared
a little bit of like what I just said.
No, I'm actually thinking of the drummer from Heart was Nancy Wilson. Mm-hmm. Wasn't it? Was Ann was the lead singer, and her sister was the drummer, I think, for a while.
She's a phenomenal guitar player.
Oh yeah, but maybe it was the good guitar, not the drums. You know, you do see that, and I was finding that out on YouTube. I was looking for something, and I tend to let myself get carried away by, you know, I wander through links and I find out things I never knew I never knew existed, things that my life was just as rich not knowing, but I still find them fascinating. I'm a trivia treasure house. I don't know why, I agree that the stereotypes are disappearing. And it's because women are becoming, I think, more comfortable with. When I was in the Marine Corps, and when it started in 72, when I first joined, I got told so many times, "You can't do that because you're a woman." I was like, "What? Really? That's your argument? that's bullshit." I would say that's specious logic, but I would push against that, and you know, I find that I had sisters out there that were doing the same thing in different areas, and it's just so many women being told that they won't get, and it's been down through the ages, so women won't get trapped in stereotypes. They refuse to get trapped in stereotypes, and men too, bless their hearts. But it seems like it's not so prevalent in the masculine gender as it is in women breaking through and doing things. Mm-hmm. And you see them having done them in World War II. Yep. You know, people forget when the pioneers were going west, these women did everything. They sure did. And it's 11:59. I hate to say it. We got 1 minute left. So I'm gonna take a brief respite here. I'm gonna take. We've got a contest for Christmas. Our next show is Christmas Eve. Everybody's invited. I'll bring the chips and the wine. But we're gonna have a great contest. We've got the artist is James Christensen, and his artwork, I specifically chose him for the fact that he's got his artwork is very holiday oriented. He's got angels and saints and Santa Clauses and Father Christmas, and we've only got two entries. But beautiful artwork. I encourage everyone to take a look at this. And I'm surprised our first entry, Titus Llewellyn. So I feel like I've arrived.
Oh.
Yeah, Titus Llewellyn was our first entry.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, big deal, big time. But seriously, yep. Gorgeous, gorgeous artwork. You can't find something that inspires you, I can't help you. But anyway, please take a look at our contest that's going for Christmas Eve, and what I'm doing now, what we're doing now with our intro music is I'm also posting who the artist is by, so when it's on the program board. So if you like the music, you at least you know who's who it's by. So anyway,
thanks for joining.
Even just 30 minutes of you is better than a lifetime with somebody else. So
I love you guys.
Absolutely.
I love
absolutely.
You too. Bless your heart, sweetheart. And Dan, thank you so much. You did a great job again. And it is the witching hour. And I'm going to pull the plug.
All right. We'll see you all later. Have a fantastic evening.
Ciao a tutti.
Have a good evening. Buenas noches. Love you guys. Love you, Bobby. Love you, Daniel.
Love you, too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.